Bonjour à toutes et à tous, bienvenue à cette balado organisée dans le cadre de la 23e édition des RIDM qui se déroule actuellement en ligne jusqu'au 2 décembre. Mon nom est Alexandre Fontaine-Rousseau, je suis animateur du podcast de la revue de cinéma 24 images et avec moi aujourd'hui Bruno Dequin qui est directeur artistique des RIDM et rédacteur en chef de 24 images. Bonjour Bruno.
Bonjour Alexandre.
Et Ariel Nasser, le réalisateur du très beau film The Forbidden Reel, qui est disponible sur le site des RIDM du 12 au 18 novembre. Ça, c'est dans la section « Confronter l'histoire ». Donc, l'entretien va se dérouler en anglais. Et puis, je vais laisser Bruno mener cet entretien. Donc, on va commencer. Bruno, tu peux y aller avec ta première question peut-être.
Oui, en fait, avant la première question, petite précision. Donc, le film d'Ariel, The Forbidden Reel, est présenté avec des sous-titres français. Donc, en fait, ça va être l'histoire interdite. Donc, pour ceux qui le cherchent sur la plateforme. Welcome, Ariel. We are very happy to have you with us today.
Thanks, Bruno. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be selected for RIDM. It's an honor and a great opportunity to connect with audiences here in Quebec.
So, it's true that it's a year that's a bit special because we are doing everything virtual. So unfortunately, we won't be able to do any screenings, but what we wanted to do was to have the opportunity to shine a light on Quebec and Canadian filmmakers, such as yourself, and to give the audience some kind of an introduction to who you are, what your world is like, where do you come from, how do you came to cinema in the first place. So maybe we don't need to start when you're like 5 years old, but if we can go back in time a bit, sure. Can you tell us a bit about how you came into the film world?
Yeah, of course. You know, I never had much involvement with film when I was younger, or so I thought. It's funny how you re-evaluate your own life as you change, right? Looking back now, I can see, you know, we used to watch a lot of ONF films, you know, we used to watch a lot of NFB films when I was a kid. We would get them from the library. And more importantly, my parents, they owned a business in a building downtown in Halifax. And just one floor up was the Repertory Cinema, Wormwood Cinema, which was a wonderful, wonderful cinema. And so we would go up and watch movies there. And there were always filmmakers coming through, were clients of my parents. It was, there was a lot of interesting experimental cinema in the city at that time. But I wasn't somebody who thought about being a filmmaker until many years later. I was in university. And actually, my plan was different. My plan was to be, at that point, either an academic, or to study law. And but I had a big life-changing event, which I won't get into details, but I had a close friend who was suffering from mental illness, and through my experiences with this person, I came to reevaluate everything that I wanted to do. In part because I myself had a nervous breakdown at that point in my life and could no longer really study. And so for that period of time when I was recovering from this, I started to make films because it seemed like another way to express myself that used a different part of my mind. And suddenly I became very interested in how to tell a story cinematically. And I started to work as a freelance editor. I taught myself video editing. And soon enough, I met a woman named Roz Power, who was the post-production technician for the National Film Board in Halifax. And she'd seen some of my work, and she was impressed with my editing and she asked if I would be her assistant. And so that's how I started. I was not only the assistant, I was the second assistant editor. So the most entry level job you can get. And I would spend my nights punching tapes. Back then it was Digibeta tapes and mini DV tapes, punching tapes into a tape deck, hundreds and hundreds of tapes, and logging every clip. So you have to describe every shot on every tape. I mean, it's the project of several weeks to just do that for one film. But the beautiful part about it was that I would see every shot from every film that came through the ONF, the National Film Board. And I saw all the brilliant moments. I saw all the mistakes. I saw all the embarrassing moments. I heard all the dialogue between the directors and the camera persons and the sound recorders and the participants. And I kind of started to understand how films are made, how documentary films are made. And when I'd had enough of that, I started to search around my environment, and I discovered that the recycling bins were full of proposals that had been edited and then discarded in the recycling bin. So I was able to look at all of these film proposals and gradually started to, through these night sessions where I was completely alone in the NFB, I gradually started to understand how I could also become a director. And so I started to put pressure on the producer to let me make a film. And I came up with some ideas and I worked at it. And eventually, over time, I was allowed to make my own film through the NFB. And so that's a little bit how I got started.
And when you're mentioning those early works, like the first films that you made them by yourself, like, because you don't mention any kind of film school or anything. You're mentioning being, you know, self-taught in editing and then going into the NFB.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, what happened is one summer after I had this nervous breakdown, I was living in an apartment, and a friend of mine moved in for the summer, and both of us a little bit lost about what we wanted to do with our lives. And together we started watching a lot of old films, a lot of silent films, and discovering all kinds of different types of cinema. And that sparked something, you know? And so the next year, the following school year, I met somebody from NASCAD, an artist who now lives in Vancouver, named Scott Saunders. And the two of us started to make films together. So we, the first thing we did was we made a documentary about student poverty. And we were able to get some funding from some of the unions that were lobbying for post-secondary education funding. And that film we made as students. So we drove all around Nova Scotia and Cape Breton to all the different universities. And we would set up these little kiosks with our camera and just interview people about their financial situation, how they were financing. And I hear all these stories about students who were working three jobs and had gone $30,000 into debt and et cetera. So we made that film. It was shown in the parliament in Nova Scotia, in the assembly. And it was kind of encouraging, you know, something came out of it. And so through that process, I learned how to edit at the university. Down in the dungeon, the basement, there was a little hole like in the wall that was called the Media Resource Center, and nobody used it, but there was a couple of computers that had Final Cut Pro, and there was a shelf that had all the manuals, you know, three books like as thick as a phone book, you know. And I started at the beginning, and when I finished reading, I had reached the index at the end of the last book. I read every page. And that's what because I had no experience with technology of any kind, really, other than how to write an essay. I thought that's how you learn, right? Mm-hmm. And so very quickly, I realized that I had somehow become one of the most knowledgeable Final Cut Pro technicians in the city, and I was able to help people with their projects, and I met a lot of people just because of that little bit of knowledge that I had gained by reading these manuals. So these kind of things. And then I was able to find my way into the National Film Board and meeting more people, and one thing at a time. And I always just looked at filmmaking as a film viewer. I became very enthusiastic about cinema, maybe because I kind of discovered it or rediscovered it, you know, as an adult. And I looked at it as a series of tasks that needed to be done in order to reach a result. And, you know, I didn't see that much mystery there. But I would have benefited from studying film. You know, I would have benefited from that for sure, you know, but that wasn't the way that my life went. And so I learned a little bit here and a little bit there, and I was lucky. I remember receiving some kind of informal classes from various camera people and craftspeople who were just part of the community, from Kent Nason to later Dureid Menajim, James Longley, a celebrated American filmmaker who I met in Afghanistan, taught me some things. So I just, I picked it up where I could, you know?
And since then, you must be aware you're probably like the only one person who has read the manuals.
Yeah, for Final Cut Pro 3 or whatever it was back then. I haven't read it for the subsequent editions, but now I'm useless with Final Cut Pro, and I'm not an editor, but you know, it's nice to have that baseline of understanding. Mm-hmm.
And you are mentioning, you know, learning films as you go and discovering also films and building up your cinephilia. Can you talk a bit about that? What are the some works that were like important to you that you discovered and made you want to do more and do things yourself?
Yeah, like in the mid 2000s, you know, like between, I don't know, 2003 and 2010, I watched a lot of documentaries, and I mean, like really just one after the other. There was a wonderful DVD rental store in Halifax, huge selection of DVDs, very well curated, and I watched as many documentaries as I could. Some documentaries that I found influential, you know, Brothers Keeper, Joe Berlinger and Bruce Yanofsky, this pair, very very influential. Werner Herzog's documentaries up to that point, very influential. Of course, Errol Morris, and then there were films that were more specific to that moment, like Tarnation was a film that I remember very well, a beautiful film. Dig, you remember Dig, one of the best music documentaries. A lot of those films were coming out that were extremely eclectic in terms of the formats that they used, using all kinds of different cameras and all kinds of different sound sources, and editing it into a beautiful mix. And it told me that everything was possible, you know, and it's about storytelling. And so the most important thing is not technical knowledge, but having the desire to tell a story and then find a way. And those films, a lot of those films were made one piece at a time, you know, and through the process of telling the story, they discovered the means to tell the story. So these were not films that had detailed treatments written at the beginning that would match the result, right? And it was inspiring to kind of launch myself into the process of filmmaking and see where it led. And I always was very collaborative. I'd love to have a few friends, you know, who were on the same adventure to make a documentary. And that was my life for many, years, both in Canada and then in Afghanistan. And some of my best memories. So it's very ad hoc for me, very one piece at a time, and seeing where I end up without really very much of a plan.
I can understand what you're mentioning about those films who whose result is has probably nothing to do with the original proposal. Like mm-hmm. you mentioned Dig, I think Dig was shot over 7 years, if I'm not mistaken, or That's something right. like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the even now, I mean, some people in Dig are not that happy with the results and
right.
how the editing put like 7 years of their life into of their lives into like a 1 hour and 45 minutes film or something. Mm. And you're mentioning this this obsession with documentary. It's always been more present than fiction, for example, or it's
mm-hmm. well, yes, for me, I loved the old silent films, you know, the fiction films. But what really captured my attention when I started to get involved in filmmaking in my 20s was the documentary. It seemed to me that's where the innovation was happening freely and without limits. So that's what excited me mm-hmm. most. I think there was also an aspect for me of wanting to tell stories that had real messages, not necessarily on the surface or in the front, but somehow behind. You know, I wanted to make art with some kind of purpose. One of the things that inspired me to start making documentaries was that at the time, Canada was fighting a war in Afghanistan against the Taliban. And there was a lot of misinformation and just poorly understood concepts that were in the media. And there were not a lot of Afghan voices. And as an Afghan Canadian, so my father's from Afghanistan, my mother's from America, very mixed heritage. But, you know, I grew up surrounded by my Afghan cousins because they were the ones who were coming to Canada. My mother's family was far away and on the west coast of the U.S., and because I used to sit at my father's feet and listen to his stories of Afghanistan, and he really told me, "You're Afghan," you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was born just before the beginning of the Soviet-Afghan War, this devastating conflict that tore the country apart, killed 2 million Afghan civilians, and drove up to 6 million Afghans out of the country. I mean, it was a catastrophe that the effects are still felt today. And so you're growing up with this knowledge that the kind of homeland is a place that is destroyed, that in some sense doesn't exist, or its very existence is sort of in danger. So you have this existential crisis kind of at the core of your being. But it is a question that you might ask, like, why did I take on this identity of being Afghan when I was half Afghan growing up in Halifax? And the answer is I don't know, except that my father, I think because I was his eldest son, he hadn't yet lost hope entirely in Afghanistan being a place that he could sort of pass on to me and that I could have a connection with. And so he chose to, you know, kind of inculcate this sense of identity in me, this sense of nationalism, the sense of pride that he had in his country. And I took it in like a small child to my very core, you know. Mm-hmm. So I grew up thinking of myself as Canadian, but also knowing that I was also Afghan. And so in this moment, this long moment after the 9/11 attack in New York, and but before, you know, it became clear that the war was going to be unsuccessful in Afghanistan, there was all this confusion. Especially for those of us who had some connection to Afghanistan, about what our role was, what our place was, what Canada's role was in Afghanistan, what was Afghanistan now? Were there some good Afghans and some bad Afghans? It was the propaganda was very shallow and probably satisfying to people who thought of Afghanistan in a very abstract way as some place far off. but to those of us who had a connection, the whole thing didn't make a lot of sense. And so I needed to know more. And so I went to Afghanistan as soon as I graduated from university. So I had been making films while I was finishing my degree. And I took a small camera with me. I did some filming. And this became a short film that I called My Fathers Are a Foreign Country. And it was about my father and some complicated family issues and my relationship to Afghanistan. And that was the first film that I made that was really me expressing myself with my voice, you know. And it was kind of a formative experience. And maybe because of that, I became sort of hooked on documenting what was happening in Afghanistan. And I think I recognized that in terms of the history of the country, there were some important things unfolding there. And in terms of the history of Canada as well, it was an important moment. And so I was compelled to go again and again to Afghanistan to make films about my father's country. And that's what kept me making my own documentaries.
Before you went to make this short film that you mentioned, what was your, beyond the words of your father and what you learned from him, what was your relationship with the actual Afghanistan? Had you been there as a kid a few times, or was it like really you as a...
Never. The first time I went was in 2005. And it's a complicated story, but basically a relative bought me a ticket. And I landed in Kabul by myself. But, you know, I came down over Afghanistan for the first time. I mean, it's spectacular. The mountains are really incredible and intimidating and but beautiful. And you come into Kabul. And back then, it was 2005, the first time I went. They still hadn't cleaned the destroyed aircrafts from the runways of Kabul International Airport. So you're flying into this place that's littered with the kind of corpses of dead airplanes, you know, and you're coming down among them. And we landed and we get off the plane. Okay, the departure lounge is just over there, pointing about 100 meters away, 200 meters away. Take my bag, go down the stairs, start walking. And all of a sudden I hear a noise behind me and I'm hit by this wind that's so powerful that it lifts me up off my feet, throws me, you know, maybe 15 meters and smashes me back onto the ground. And I turn around, you know, kind of craning my neck to see what it was. And the plane had just turned around and its rear jets had hit us as we were walking and we just all went flat. So things were still quite disorganized when I first went there. But, you know, on the other hand, they were hopeful. There was still hope. People were still happy to see, you know, outsiders coming in. So it was an exciting time to be there. But I just really... had this real first experience of being completely knocked off my feet, you know, and it set the tone a little bit. And for the next decade, I was completely obsessed with Afghanistan and wanting to be part of Afghanistan and wanting to understand and inherit, you know, this connection to this country. And I did, and there was a lot of good stuff that came out of that. Of course, there was a lot of difficult stuff too, because as a Canadian, I hadn't been exposed to a lot of violence or war. And after I returned for many years, I suffered from elevated anxiety, depression, until finally I saw a psychiatrist and I was diagnosed with a mild case of PTSD and given some medication. After a couple of years, I was okay. But the whole thing was, quite shocking in many ways. Changed, that was a transformative time in my life. And one of the most powerful things about it, aside from meeting my family there, is that I met all kinds of people like myself who had been born or raised outside of Afghanistan, but who had these connections to Afghanistan through one of their parents or both. And they'd come back in this time when the country was sort of wide open to welcome outsiders. And there was this kind of need for expertise, and people were coming from all over the world, young Afghan, you know, Afghan Australians, Afghan Germans, Afghan Canadians, Afghan Americans. And I was able to meet all of these people who were a little bit like me, more than I'd ever met anyone in my life, you know? So we, it was a very formative and powerful time for me. And we jokingly called ourselves the Afghans, half Afghan, Afghans. And, you know, we were like, we were welcome in the country because Afghanistan is a very basically tribal in the sense society that politics are organized mainly through family connection, clan connection, work is organized through family and clan. So in that sense, the distance that we had, whether culturally, linguistically, physically, geographically, well, that was a barrier, but the stronger thing was the fact that we were family. We were still connected to our Afghan families by blood, and that was enough. And so there we were, and we were all, many of us were learning to speak Dari better than we did before. In my case, I spoke very little before I went there, or Pashto, depending on the family. And it was a wonderful time.
Can you talk a bit about the evolution of your relationship with Afghanistan, but also the evolution of your work there throughout the films that you made during this period? Because you started as a some kind of a one-man crew.
Yeah.
And then did you slowly like develop, you know, connections, get fixers, or like, you know, work with local crews or filmmakers or?
Yeah, I mean, even when I was a one-man crew, I mean, the first time I went there, it was just me hitchhiking around the country with the palm quarter. We used to call the palm quarter. Remember the little ones that fit in your palm? And but then, you know, over time, yeah, I would always try to recruit help. You know, I would always try to get help. And I was easy to make friends there. It's a very easy, welcoming, gentle, sweet culture where people are extremely hospitable to outsiders. Typically, obviously, through, you know, 30, 40 years of conflict, it can change that. But I was able to meet a lot of wonderful people. I was very lucky and began working with more and more with the people there. And, you know, I kind of made a rule for myself as I went forward in working in Afghanistan that I would follow the rules that every Afghan follows, because many foreign filmmakers were taking a lot of shortcuts around the rules. They would be told, yeah, you have to go and get a permit and do this and do that. And they wouldn't do it because from their perspective, it wasn't worthwhile. But I was there for longer. I felt I wanted to have a lifelong connection with the place. Their relationships were as important to me as anything else. And most importantly, I had gone to the trouble to get myself an Afghan citizenship. And so, which I was eligible for because of my father. And I felt as an Afghan citizen, I had to live up to a higher standard than that. So I did. So I would go to the film authority, this place called Afghan Film, to get my permits. And I mean, the first time I went down there, it was like a little intimidating. It's this old war-torn building. I mean, it has bullet holes in the sides and it's dark. And, but, full inside, full of like the relics of, you know, decades and decades of filmmaking, old film canisters and archives and old Soviet era trophies from film festivals in the Soviet Republic. And I met engineer Latif, and he was the president at the time, and he helped me, and we cooperated on making films. But because of my connection with him, and eventually with the Ministry of Information and Culture, and with the Ministry of Interior, and all of these connections that I made as I followed the rules, these very bureaucratic and time-consuming things you had to do, I became kind of an expert in producing in Afghanistan, to the point where it was easy for me to help others to do the same. And I realized all these benefits, you know, it turns out that Afghan film actually had this wonderful German film grip equipment. So they had a beautiful dolly, and they had a crane, and nobody was going to bring a dolly or a crane into the country from outside. So that was it. You know, if you wanted the dolly, or if you wanted a beautiful crane shot in the mountains, you had to get it from there. And so I formed all these relationships, and I began to produce other things, a lot of commercial stuff, a lot of stuff for the aid organizations that were there. And eventually the short film called the Buzkashi Boys that went to the Oscars in 2013, a very proud moment, because I was able to take the two young actors, one of whom we had actually met when he was selling maps in the street to foreigners. So he was from an impoverished family, that he had lost his father, but clearly very bright and very charismatic and wanted to act. And eventually he acted in the film alongside another young boy. So their names are Jawanmard and Fawad, and these two actors eventually came with us and were at the Oscars, and they were sitting at the Oscars, these boys who had never been out of Kabul, Afghanistan, and who had these dreams of being great actors. And you know, we even went afterwards to DC. We were invited by the US State Department to go to DC and give a talk and tour the White House. And so, I mean, you know, why not? And in fact, one of the reasons why we accepted that invitation was because at the time, the head of Afghanistan's National Security Organization, he had been in a suicide attack, an assassination attempt, and he was actually in Walter Reed Hospital in DC. And the boys had a link to him. They had a connection to him through one of the two boys, who was a little bit more from a middle-class family. And they wanted to talk to him because he had heard about the film. He wanted to see them. And they thought, okay, here we are in LA. It's great. We're getting our picture out. Everybody's heard of us. But when we go to Afghanistan, are we going to be in danger, right? Because now we have all this notoriety as people who love America, whatever, have been to the Oscars. So it was strategic for them to go to DC. And I went with them to Walter Reed Hospital, and we visited this incredible Afghan official, and he kind of had a talk with them about how to take care of themselves when they went back, and gave them his card and told them he'd look out for them. And the whole thing was quite amazing. And when we walked through the White House together, Barack Obama came through, and one of his aides was walking behind him and said, "These are the boys from Buzkashi Boys." And Barack Obama turned around and looked at he didn't look at me, but he looked at the two boys, and he said, "Great work." And then he walked away. And you know, the looks on their faces, I mean, it was great. It was fantastic to be able to travel with them, and for them to be able to kind of touch this very rarefied you know, piece of American culture. And now one of them, Fawad, has actually received a scholarship to Oberlin University in Ohio, a swing state, and he's going to he's gonna start school there, hopefully next semester. So he's actually was supposed to start in September, but that was delayed because of the pandemic. So you know, lots of very satisfying experiences, and I was also able to make some documentaries Good Morning Kandahar and The Boxing Girls of Kabul, you know, made a lot of amazing connections. In fact, one of the boxers from The Boxing Girls of Kabul now lives here in Montreal, came here as a refugee about 4 years ago. And then the coach of the women's boxing team of Afghanistan followed her a couple of years later and is now here too. So it's mm-hmm. very gratifying to me to still have relationships with these people from films I'd made a long time ago.
And you also mentioned this, the fact that as an Afghan, you wanted to follow the official route. So you went to Afghan film. That's where you met Engineer Latif, which brings us to actually the film that you opened this year, which is The Forbidden Reel. Actually, like late last year, to be more specific, but that will be shown during our IDM. So Forbidden Reel, Histoire Interdite, which is about Afghan film, actually, mm-hmm. and about the archives that you discovered there. First of all, yeah, I would like you to talk a bit about how this came into being, because the film starts with, in parts, like an interview with Mariam Ghani, who is a scholar and researcher specializing in those archives. So did the film start with her or with you and your own, you know, personal connection with Latif and the Afghan film crews? Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. The film actually started with Engineer Latif handing me a script and saying, now that you're back from Hollywood, can you produce my film? And I said, I don't know. Can you show me one of your films from the past? Respectfully, I asked, because I honestly didn't know what to expect. I didn't know he was a filmmaker, to be honest. I didn't know he was really a filmmaker. I know he thought of himself as a filmmaker, but I had never heard of a film industry in Afghanistan, and I knew a lot about Afghanistan, and, you know, or so I thought. So he gave me a DVD and I played it without much expectation, and it blew my mind. It was an excellent film, and it was Afghan, and a beautiful film, sharp political critique of the class system. It was socialist. It was extremely creative, a beautiful black and white film. And it's called Akhtar the Joker. And it's featured a little bit in our film. So after watching that film, I had a whole new level of respect for him. And I went and talked to him again. And I told him how incredibly honored I was that he would ask me to produce his film. He was delighted. He gave me more films to watch. I discovered more and more of his work. And I started to discover the work of other filmmakers, Afghan filmmakers, and realized there's this whole body of work. More than that, there's this whole facets of world cinema that sort of remained undiscovered. And in those days, around a few years after that, there was this moment of interest. Word kind of got out about these films. And somebody came from the World Cinema Foundation, which is Martin Scorsese's group, and wanted to survey, you know, the films that were in the archive, and with the thought that they would preserve one of them. That's what they were doing. They were going to various national archives at the time in the developing world, and they were choosing one film out of like a body of work, an unknown piece of world cinema, and they would enshrine that one piece and give it the full treatment, you know, totally restore it. And unfortunately, they eventually left without following it up. There's a lot of complication around getting films out of the country because there's been so much theft of Afghan cultural materials, Afghan cultural artifacts over many, many decades. They're just very sensitive, understandably so, about letting somebody take something out, and also somewhat wary of promises, because so many promises have been made to Afghan people and Afghan institutions. So they were not successful in doing that, but I was happy to see that they were there and remained interested for many years. A couple years later, it might have been just a year after, my uncle, who was working in Kabul as a translator and researcher, he told me that he had worked with Maryam Ghani, translating some materials from the archive. Maryam, like me, was born in North America. She was born in the US. Mm-hmm. He was translating some material for her. And so at that time, her father was not the president of Afghanistan, but she was already doing this work. So the results of that work was that a little bit more of that material was made available. You can find some of it on an academic website, but it was like very low quality, really for researchers, little clips. Again, the archive didn't want to let the entire films be put out there. So I saw some clips I hadn't seen before through that, and my interest was piqued again. All of which led me in 2012 to actually write a proposal and pitch this to the National Film Board. And I had worked at that point on 3 or 4 projects with the National Film Board. So I, 3 projects. So I had a relationship with a producer there named Annette Clark, and I pitched it to her, and the NFB did not take the film at that time. And a couple of years went by, and I found another producer, an independent producer named Sergio Kirby, working in Montreal. And Sergio and I began to make the film together. And it was this long process, because it's daunting to think about researching a film archive where the films, like 99% of the films, only exist in film format. So if you want to watch them, you have to go into the archive, which is, there's no catalog, just films in cans on shelves, you know, and people who know what is what, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially because as we've seen the films, the films are labeled by numbers now, right, instead of their titles.
That's right.
For a reason that you might explain to people who haven't seen the film yet. But
yeah, of course. Well, yes, there was this tragic moment in Afghan history where the Taliban were able to take over most of the country. And they took Kabul, among other, the rest of the country, almost the whole thing, except for some points north. And there were some iconoclastic fanatics who were destroying works of art systematically in Afghanistan with the support of the Taliban. And they came one day to the archive to burn the films. But fortunately, the archivists knew they were coming. They had been tipped off by an insider, and they were able to hide the archives, thankfully. And they offered a bunch of cellular, like a bunch of films, but they were not important films. They were works of Bollywood and Hollywood and prints, foreign prints that the Afghan Film Archive had distributed to cinemas, you know. So they burned those instead, and thought that they had destroyed Afghan cinema heritage, you know, for good. They left, and the films remained hidden for many years until 2001. When the Taliban were deposed by the NATO alliance, US-led NATO alliance, and you had this situation where all of a sudden these filmmakers started to come back. Now, I should preface this by saying that these filmmakers, they're very interesting, and each is different. But the most successful of them tend to be, in some ways, the least political, in the sense that I don't want to say that they're apolitical. They're not, but their politics are always superseded by this overarching passion for cinema that is so intense that it goes beyond everything else. As one of the participants, Siddiq Barmak, a well-known, celebrated filmmaker, actually, said, you know, a friend wanted him to join the Communist Party, and he said, I am sorry, but I already belong to the Cinema Party. He's really sees all his hopes, passions, and aspirations in cinema, in the world of cinema. And Siddiq Barmak was the first to get back to Afghanistan. Most of these filmmakers had been in exile, not all, but most of them. And he took over Afghan film again and, you know, started to find all these films hidden away. And he discovered all kinds of all the works that he had believed had been burned. Because, of course, after the Taliban burned these films, the news went out. BBC, for example, carried this story, and the filmmakers thought they'd lost everything. They thought everything was gone. And so they discovered in the end, it was all still there, thanks to the work of these archivists. And you know, the interesting thing, one of the guys who stayed at the archive well into the Taliban period was a cameraman by the name of Qadir Tahiri, and he directed this film House of History, and it was a film that just hit me like right in the gut. It's really the only film that was made during the Civil War period that showed the Civil War. Now, this was an era just before the Taliban, when the kind of saviors of the country, the Mujahideen, who had driven the Red Army and the Soviets and the Communists out of the country, and were perceived to be the kind of liberators of Afghanistan, at least in the West, they tore the country apart in a bloody power struggle, and particularly Kabul, which had remained somewhat untouched and even had increased in size and development under the Soviets, under the communist, Afghan communist rule, was torn to pieces. And many, many, many civilians lost their lives. The country was systematically destroyed by various factions of the Mujahideen. And it was a period when it was dangerous to critique anyone, because the country was full of armed factions. It was being ruled by the gun. And so during this period, one filmmaker had the sort of guts to make a documentary that documented what was happening in front of his eyes and was a kind of a terrible lament, you know, to mourn the loss of culture and the loss of Afghan culture, both in terms of the National Museum, for example, which had been completely looted, but also in terms of the loss of life, and the loss of civility, the loss of human kindness. It's a wonderful film. It's called The House of History. And I always wanted to know where this director was. And eventually I tracked him down, and he was in Montreal. And I brought him into the studio during the offline edit, and he said he was over the moon. He was so happy. And I promised him to screen his film, because his film in its entirety had never been shown in Afghanistan or anywhere, because it was banned the moment it was made. And so in collaboration with Concordia University, there were some grad students who had some money to do some screenings, and we put on a public screening for him in a good cinema, and showed his film, The House of History, and many people came, and he spoke, and it was like the world premiere of of the House of History by Qadir Tahiti. And that was a really moving moment for me because something concrete had happened in some sense, you know. I made the film as an homage to these directors who were so little known. And even though it was such a small thing, I could just see in his face the how important it was to have a screening of his film for the first time. So yeah, the unexpected connections, you know.
Do you know if some more of these films will be available anytime at some point?
It's a very good question. One thing that we're currently working on is a small website that will have more material. It's a small project to allow you to kind of navigate through some of the raw archival material using a little very simple navigation tool to go from decade to decade. Unfortunately, we're not able to screen the films in their entirety because there are rights issues. They do belong to Afghan Film, and which is technically a government agency. And so when we tried to get the rights to screen them publicly, we ran into a lot of complicated legal issues. And basically, the willingness was not there at this point to do it. But I'm very hopeful that one day soon we'll be able to.
A part of the film is, as you said, an homage to filmmakers that we haven't heard about, unless we're like hyper-specialized in Afghan cinema, which very few people are. Another part of the film is using those films to talk about Afghan recent history.
That's right.
Show the country in another light. So for someone like you who already had some knowledge of Afghanistan, are there like a few things that you could mention that, you know, throughout this archival work, it completely changed your mind on, you know, a certain period, because certain periods of Afghan history are almost not available at all for people. And also in the film, the researcher that we mentioned earlier, she says that now that those images are available again, we might not be ready yet to process them. Maybe we will one day, but yeah. But you know, right now it's kind of too early in some ways. So how do you feel about that?
I defer to her knowledge. She's a wise person, but she also sees things through a more political lens in some ways, as a result of being the daughter of the president of Afghanistan. And that's important. It's important for her to think that way. But personally, I think there will never be a better time. You know, this stuff needs to be seen. And there's so much reconciliation that hasn't happened, so much justice that hasn't happened from all the war crimes that were committed. It probably will never happen. Probably systematically, those crimes will never be addressed. And there may be a few examples made at some point if things are stable enough. But even that hasn't happened so far. So I think for those people who are waiting for justice, for those people who have given up hope, for those people who were harmed by war crimes, this is the only way that they get to have any sense of, okay, this actually happened. At least there's some tangible evidence of it, and it's important to have that. And I think this material should be out there. It should be out there. It should be part of conversations about Afghanistan because it fills in important gaps in Afghan history. When we were talking about the film very early on, I knew that I wanted to do three things with the archives. I wanted to use the archives to talk about Afghan cinema, of course, and this is the most basic level, but I also wanted to use them to talk about Afghan history. Some of them are fictional, so there's a fine line, but we used a treatment that was more creative to try to mix the documentary footage with fiction footage to kind of bring the richest kind of sense of what was happening in the culture at that moment in Kabul to the screen. Then the third way was to fill in some of the gaps of the filmmakers' lives, to try and illustrate their lives with the films that they had made. And they hadn't made films about their own lives. And to fill some of those holes, we actually went to Afghanistan and filmed some recreations in the same style, hopefully, as close as we could with film. So we used 16mm film, as a lot of their films had used. And we used a crew from the national, from Afghan Films, and even a lot of their equipment. So it was like a kind of an homage to them to do that. And finally, I just want to say that I was so proud of the National Film Board of Canada to become involved with Afghan Film in a way that, you know, you could see these two sister organizations working together for kind of common goals. And the technicians at National Film Board of Canada were able to digitize films that we were lucky enough to bring to Canada to borrow for temporarily. And we returned them along with beautiful state-of-the-art digital copies, which you cannot make in Afghanistan and probably won't be able to for some years to come. So that was a real moment of pride to see, you know, these two countries that I love and that both of which I have a relationship with coming together through cinema. It was a beautiful moment, actually.
Thank you both for this. Your film is called The Forbidden Reel. It's beautiful. Actually, I watched it yesterday and I was very moved by it. And it's available from the 12th to the 18th of November on the RDM platform. Je vais répéter ça en anglais. Merci Ariel et Bruno pour cette belle rencontre. Le film The Forbidden Reel fait partie de la section Confronter l'histoire. Il est disponible sur la plateforme en ligne des RDM du 12 au 18 novembre. On se retrouve bientôt pour un autre balado des RDM. Et d'ici là, Ariel, Bruno, merci d'avoir été avec nous.
Merci, Alexandre.